Welcome everyone to the Alturas Institute's presentation of America Reimagined, our radio show that invites experts from across the country to consider what America might look like under different circumstances, policies, and programs. The Alturas Institute is an educational nonprofit organization dedicated to defending American democracy by advancing the Constitution, civic education, gender equality, and equal protection of the law.
We are very pleased today to invite to our show Professor Joanne Freeman, the class of 1954, professor of history and American studies at Yale University. She is an acclaimed scholar, well known to the public for her work in helping to produce the Broadway hit on Hamilton. She is the author of Fields of Blood and Affairs of Honor, in addition to an edited work on Alexander Hamilton. She's also the co-host of the acclaimed podcast, Backstory, and also the host of a wonderful history webinar, History Matters, and So Does Coffee. Joanne Freeman is also a frequent national commentator on important issues confronting America. You'll find her writings, essays, and commentary in Atlantic Magazine, the New York Times, the Washington Post. No doubt you've seen her on national documentaries presented by PBS and the History Channel, among others. She is the recipient of all the prestigious awards that the world of academia can bestow upon its very best. Today, Joanne Freeman joins us to talk about a couple of issues of great importance to American voters this particular week, and that is beginning with the question of a peaceful transition to power, a norm in our country that has always been a given. And yet, as you all know, in the last several months, President Donald Trump has either refused or only reluctantly agreed to a peaceful transition of power should he lose in the November election. Professor Freeman, welcome to our show. It's a pleasure to host you.
Thanks for having me.
So Joanne, as you consider President Trump's reluctance, at least at a minimum, to state his agreement that he would peacefully transfer power should he lose in the November election, How did those words strike you as a historian of the early republic and a historian who follows American events and issues across the centuries?
Not surprisingly, those words struck me in a couple of different ways. One of them, and it's been my experience of the entire Trump presidency, is the reality of something that I've been teaching at Yale as long as I've been there, so over 20 years, that intellectually I understood but didn't fully understand in my gut, and that is norms and the importance of norms. So when I teach the Constitution, I tell my students, you know, it's a remarkably brief document for what it does. It's really the skeleton of a government. And the assumption was that when the government went into effect in 1789 and thereafter, precedents would be set. And there are all kinds of norms that over the centuries really have made our system function. I don't think we've ever fully thought about the degree to which norms are the sort of undercurrent of our government and how it runs. So the first thing that I thought when someone, you know, a president says, I may or may not step down, right? Your automatic response to that is, wait, he can't do that. And then you realize, oh, well, actually, that in a sense, that falls into the category of a norm that most people who agree to abide by our constitutional system of governance would abide by. What happens if someone doesn't choose to follow that path? What do you do? So, you know, I think again and again and again over the last few years, we've seen moments come up, and I think in one way or another, people have said, well, surely they can't do that. Surely he can't do that. And we found again and again and again, well, yeah, in some ways you can. How do you stop it? And in other ways, accountability is pretty central to our system of government. And that's another thing that, again, I've said happily for decades, you know, accountability, right? That's how a democratic government works, is that the people give power and the people can take it away and people who have power are accountable for that power. And that's nice to say, but what we've seen over the course of the last few years is not a lot of accountability. And without it, people keep pushing the envelope because there's no penalty to not doing it. So all of these kind of general assumptions about the Constitution are part of what went into my mind. Also, the importance of just the system of government that we agree to abide by. I mean, the Constitution, as I've called it elsewhere, a pact that we, the people, form with each other and that those in power form with us as to how a system shall operate. That's such a vital core of what the nation is and how we feel about ourselves as a we, as a nation. And this question about a transition of power is kind of a stab at the ongoing process of government, even if there's not a direct line in the Constitution that you can necessarily point to. So on all of these levels, 10 years ago, would any of us have been thinking that this moment would come along? Probably not. So as a historian, I don't like to say that things are unprecedented because you're usually wrong, but you and I can sit here, Dave, and we can go back in time and talk about other moments that were fraught, other elections that were really fraught or problematic, other crises when Americans did at some point turn on each other, but no two of them are the same. And that's really kind of where we are now, is that there are ways in which over the long view as a historian, you can say, well, I see things happening now that have happened before, but the particular combination of them and how they're playing out, that's particular to our moment.
And Joanne, when you talk about historical democratic norms and what Americans expect from their leaders and on the issue of accountability, how is it that Americans should perceive this refusal or this reluctance to acknowledge a peaceful transition to power? If this strikes at the very core of American democracy, does this threaten the future of democracy? And what does history tell us about the threats to American democracy over time?
Well, I think, and this is not going to surprise anyone who's listening, all over the world, democracy is being challenged and questioned and thought about. So this isn't a case in which the United States is alone. And I think the world, including the United States, is learning something that certainly we took for granted, which is it doesn't go autopilot. It's not something you can take for granted. We have been taking it for granted. And it requires work and it requires diligence and alertness and awareness and a lot of things that I think for a good stretch of time, Americans really haven't thought about. So I think just on that, in that way, it's certainly, we're being educated about democracy right now. That said, I've thought, so at some early point when I began to get alarmed, long before the election, I began to think really seriously about how to frame my anxieties. I didn't want to come rushing out into public and say, alarm, alarm, democracy, democracy. Because I thought if I start doing that 3 years ahead of an election, by the time the election comes around, no one's going to hear me anymore. They're going to be numb. So I've been thinking for a couple of years now how to talk about my gut sense of the threat to democracy. And now, I've just come out and said, I talk a lot about politics on Twitter, about the Constitution and teaching politics in the Constitution on Twitter. And I have now said point blank that democracy is on the ballot. And I believe that is the case. I believe that a president who says that he will not necessarily step down if we, the people, basically say, you know what, we don't want you to be president anymore. That is a person who has turned his back on democracy. I mean, that's just with or without all of the trappings that go along with that. If the people vote and make a decision and a person says, I don't care, that is a person who is not abiding by democracy.
And Joanne, as a historian of the early American Republic, you are very familiar with the framers' warnings that a Republican form of government is fragile. It needs to be nourished. This is an opportunity, I think, as you say, for Americans to remember those early admonitions.
Absolutely. And, so they absolutely taught that. And again, the American experiment went into effect in a world of monarchies. So this seemingly, in comparison with a monarchy, is a fragile form of government grounded to an extreme degree on public opinion, on we the people. We the people can be kind of, we can sort of zip all over the place. We're not necessarily always stable. That means that a republic is unstable. And again, you need to be careful about what you are doing both as the people and as leaders in a republic, This is why the founders spoke so often about demagogues, because they looked to the ancient past, they looked to Greece, they looked to Rome, and they understood that the number one way in which republics go down is through a demagogue, because demagogues do the very thing that a republic is fragile, is vulnerable to. A demagogue steps forward, a demagogue appeals to the public, giving them whatever it is that they want, gets them all excited, and then gets power and does whatever the heck he or she wants to do. So, you know, there are all kinds of spiffy quotes that I can offer you from the founding era saying, you know, demagogues, watch for demagogues. In some ways, we're also experiencing the fragility of our country to that particular kind of a threat, not for the first time, but in an extreme kind of a way.
And when you point out not for the first time, it reminds me of your acclaimed book, Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to the Civil War, as a historian who has written quite a lot, I would say, about violence in America. You're surely alive to the concerns across our country that there may be violence in American streets after this election and perhaps for some time. Does that fear resonate with you? Do you see any parallels to circumstances that led to violence in America in the run-up to the Civil War?
Well, you know, that's a difficult topic for me. I write a lot about political violence, so anything having to do with violence and politics in some way resonates with me. That said, I've been holding back on talking about violence after the election because I don't want to encourage people to see that as a valid option. Not that people need me to believe that, but I really have sort of wanted to hold back and see what's happening. Now, that said, the United States, as long as it's been in existence, has been a violent country. Its politics have always, in one way or another, been violent, not necessarily to an extreme degree, but still. Riots at polling places, you know, any number of forms of violence, including the kind that I wrote about in my most recent book, The Field of Blood, which is about physical violence in the U.S. Congress. And what's interesting about that, and what kind of resonates with the current moment, is that what you see in that book is that the slaveholding South, to protect the institution of slavery and protect the South as they wanted it to be, used physical violence in Congress to intimidate, threaten, and silence people who stepped forward to threaten it. So basically Northerners, a lot of Northerners were bullied into silence or threatened into silence or sometimes beaten in one way or another into silence. So a lot of that violence is explicitly power holders, because the South had a great deal of power in the Union, more than they should have representatively. And to keep their power, to keep their hold over the national government, they were using violence and using threats and using bullying to maintain a hold. Now, you know, I've toyed with and not written an op-ed about bullying, because we are in a moment of great political bullying on a lot of different fronts. And bullying rests on the threat of something, not on the actual thing being carried out. So for example, if people are afraid there will be violence, they'll stay home even if there is none, you know? So there's a psychology to this that can potentially operate against the people who don't have power. But what we're looking at now is people with power doing anything that they can. And some of it involves in some way threats or intimidation. And as you're even suggesting, maybe the threat of violence to maintain a hold on what they feel they are entitled to have. You know, the system of government that we have agreed to share with each other is grounded on debate and compromise. Some things can't be compromised, I suppose, and not everything can be debated. But the idea that people who step forward and say, I'm going to be violent and prevent you from voting, so you better stay home, that there's no space for that in the system. We've been, over the course of our history, better and worse at taking hold of that. So, you know, Jim Crow and all of the ways in which people were prevented from getting the vote through force, through intimidation, through, you know, here, take this test, here, pay this fine. We have not been always very vigilant or very careful or very even thoughtful or energetic about fighting against that kind of behavior. But again, as a historian, I can stand back and point to things and say, this reminds me, but no two moments are the same. And one of the reasons why I think that's important has to do with the moment that we're in now. And the webcast that you mentioned, History Matters, that I do on Thursday mornings. So I've been doing it for about 7 months. And 7 months ago, the first one I did was about contingency. And I talked about how important it is when you look at history to remember that people at the time didn't know what would happen. It's easy for us to look back and say, well, of course, they won the revolution, and of course, they wrote a constitution, and of course, and there aren't, of courses, when you're living through life, right? And particularly when you're living through history. That's important for this moment because I think there's a tendency still, unbelievably, but still, for some people to think it's all going to be okay because it always has been okay because we're the United States of America, and so it'll be okay. We cannot assume that. But I also think it's possible to assume, well, that's it. We're done. It's been a nice run. Government's over. We're no longer going to be a democracy. And I don't think you can assume that either. And it's why I think it's so important to think about contingency right now, because the fact of the matter is we don't know, for better and worse, we don't know not only the outcome of the election, but where we're going after that. And what that means is all of us as Americans need to be engaged and alert and alive to our rights and to the ways in which we have a right to step forward and assert them. We should not be just stepping back and either assuming it's going to be good and or it's going to be bad, because we don't know. And I think American exceptionalism and the idea that somehow everything is fine here because we're the United States is blinding people in some way to the full spectrum of things that can happen in the weeks and months ahead. And I think people need to be realistic and thoughtful about what might come and what they might do if it does.
I like your point very much. Nothing's been determined. Nothing's been foreordained. Still many, many tools and powers within the hands of the American people to make a choice to determine the future course of our country. It reminds me of James Madison's beautiful essay in Federalist 51, one of my favorites, in which he argued that the maintenance of the Republic depends a lot on the interest of the people, the engagement of the people. And I was thinking about that as I read your beautiful essay in Atlantic in August. Is this not a time for Americans to become re-educated about our democratic ideals and to realize that the maintenance of the Republic depends on their shoulders, as Madison said?
Absolutely. And I think, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I think I've just spoken about dire possibilities for a good 5 minutes. And as that essay discusses, there are dire possibilities. But the fact of the matter is that a moment possible enormous change like the one we're in also means that there's possibility, right? It also means that there's a possibility of positive change. And I think that's true. And I think if you're going to look for positives in amidst the many negatives that we're experiencing right now, one of them is that I do think Americans are thinking more about democracy in a thoughtful, meaningful, personal way. I think that some people, in particular white Americans, white elite Americans who haven't thought hard about what it means to have it or not have it, are thinking about that in a way that they haven't before. I think that young people are understanding and stepping up. Apparently, the numbers are vast as far as who has already voted of young people, and they're energized and they're willing to be active. So if you're looking for a positive to sort of put out on the table amidst everything else, one of them is we are in an educational moment about democracy, and some lessons are being learned, and we will come out of this experience different in one way or another. And ideally, one of those differences will be we will understand the value and the meaning of democracy in a different way, and we will be better at protecting it.
I like that very much. And as we talk about the process of re-education for Americans about the ideals and the values and the virtues of American democracy, isn't one way to help Americans appreciate those virtues and values to invite them to look at the horrors that afflicted Europe, for example, in the 19th century, to realize the great disparity between, let us say, an authoritarian system and a democracy? We can learn from history in that way, true?
We can, and that raises a related point that I've just begun writing about and haven't done it yet, but it has to do with authoritarianism. It has to do with a string of words: authoritarianism, fascism, socialism, democracy, communism. People are throwing around a lot of words right now, and a lot of people are not thinking in any way about what they mean, right? They're just buzzwords. And I think authoritarianism, I think that that's one of them, right? What does it mean? If people who know what it means say that, I don't think that necessarily has an impact on people who are listening, because I don't think they understand what that means. And I think the same holds true for democracy. I think that people know, you know, when I teach my courses, I tell my students that they can't write papers that just say liberty, freedom, democracy, because I call that democraspeak, because it's just throwing around a bunch of buzzwords that don't in and of themselves have meaning. And so I think you're right. I think if you look at history, that's one way of making real some of the things that people are not understanding the reality of right now. I mean, I think there's a reason why historians have a lot to say at this current moment. You know, there are a lot of historians writing for the public, writing op-eds, speaking to the public more than is typically true. I'd be happy if it keeps going, because I think that should be a conversation that keeps happening. But that's the reason why, is because if people, they might not understand the current moment, but history can help them understand the reality of what has happened, what is happening, and what could happen.
So, Joanne, what you say about learning from history reminds me that the framers believed that history was a vast treasure trove of knowledge from which we could draw to construct the Union and the new Constitution and the new form of government. We're at a point where Americans would be strongly encouraged to review history, because even if it doesn't repeat, it tends to rhyme.
It certainly echoes. You know, I've seen a lot of words put in that slot: repeat, echo, rhyme, reverberate, resonate. The fact of the matter is, the past certainly educates and has important lessons that makes us better understand the roots of where we are and the patterns of events as they've unfolded before and what that might lead us to think about now. So for example, at moments like this, when people are fearful and they don't know where things are going, conspiracy theories go off the charts. Make sense on a basic logical level, that if people don't know what's happening, they invent reasons so that they feel better, even if it's a crazy upsetting reason, they feel better that there's a reason. So, you know, if you look back at different moments, if you look at the lead up to the presidential election of 1800, which was a very fraught one, and there was a threat of violence, there were all kinds of conspiracy theories. There were people saying that Jefferson was going to come for your Bible, so you better bury it so he can't take it away when he becomes president. There were all kinds of ideas and theories and threats and conspiracies floating around in the air at moments like this. So in and of itself, that's helpful, right? Because we can see that flying around us right now. And I think it's important to know that some of what we're seeing isn't distinctive to this moment. It's actually what happens in this kind of moment, and that should give it somewhat less power as some kind of an important force, and should allow people to realize that probably there's a lot of stuff flying around right now that should not be taken seriously.
You know, I appreciate that point very much. And in our last couple of minutes together, when you talk about the maintenance of our constitutional system, we talk all the time about the importance of protecting checks and balances. Do you feel at this moment or over the last few years that the doctrine of checks and balances has been under assault?
Yes, but here's what I learned by watching that. Now, on the one hand, checks and balances are about channeling power, and that's why they're vital to our system. That said, our system has shifted over the years. You know, the executive branch has become more powerful in different ways. So you can't point to this moment and say something's happening now that is only happening this moment. That said, we do have a particular president who doesn't really have much thought for the other branches and any of the checks. And we're watching that play out. Now, what's interesting about that, and this gets back to some of what the Alturas Institute does and some of what we're talking about with history. During the campaign to the last election, Trump made an attack against a judge that became an attack sort of suggesting that the justice system is not an independent power in and of itself, which alarmed me for this reason. You know, checks and balances, the executive branch, that's not how they relate ideally to the judicial branch. And I went on Twitter and I said, I know this is obvious and I know that everyone knows this, but I have to say it because someone has to say it. Checks and balances and the separation of powers are the basis of our system of government. And I explained it, and I did it in a really basic way. I said, you know, every branch of government has a superpower. They have different superpowers. And I explained it at length. And then I apologized at the end and said, I know how obvious this is, but we need to understand the importance of that. And a lot of people responded by saying, thank you for explaining that. I never understood that. And if that's the case, which it appears to be, then there's a lot of educating that needs to go on for people to kind of gets us back to where we started, for people to understand what democracy is, how it works, what our Constitution is, what it can and can't do, and how things can happen if there isn't accountability. And some of that accountability comes from us.
America in 2020 represents a genuine teaching moment. And I know that you will continue to think about it, write about it, and I hope you'll come back and join us because you have so very much to share with us. So look for an invitation in your email box. Thank you so very much, Joanne, for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. I'm so sorry the time has gone by so very quickly. Be well. Take care.
Thanks for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just been listening to another edition of America Reimagined, presented by the Alturas Institute. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains.
Audio and guest information for all episodes of America Reimagined can be found at kisu.org. Production assistance is provided by Taylor Nadal and Mandy Gardner. For more information about the Alturas Institute, visit alturasinstitute.com. Our rendition of America the Beautiful is a new arrangement created by the talented musician Steve Eaton and sung by Idaho State Senator Sherry Buckner Webb and 8-year-old Charlotte Laval.